You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Glenn Packiam, is an associate senior pastor at New Life Church, a multi-congregational church in Colorado Springs. He also serves as the lead pastor of New Life Downtown, a thriving congregation in the heart of the city. Packiam treasures both ancient and modern Christian practices. He has a doctorate in theology and ministry from Durham University in the UK. Glenn, his wife Holly, and their children live in Colorado Springs. Glenn, welcome back to Seminary Dropout.
Hey, Shane. Great to talk to you again, man.
Man, I was looking at the last time you were here. That was like years ago.
It was.
And I'm looking now, 2015. That's crazy. That was such
a
long time ago.
That is crazy, man.
I often laugh when I look back at those in my older interviews. You can fill so many books with things I didn't know several years ago. I mean, so case in point, we talked a lot about in that episode about how you had become an Anglican priest. You got ordained in the Anglican, which and your church is not an Anglican church.
Right, correct.
So the funny part about it is I have several Anglican friends. I know a lot more about Anglicanism and have a lot of affinity toward it. I didn't know anything. And I remembered when I published that episode, I put something in the notes of like, Glenn became, is an Anglican priest, even though he's a Protestant or something like that. And you so kindly sent me a private message. You're just like, hey man, FYI, like Anglican is a Protestant.
Yeah.
That's something that I just laugh about that. So much. So great. I don't know what in my head that it was. I didn't know if I was thinking like Eastern Orthodox or something.
Right.
Oh man.
I'm there for you, man.
Oh man. So many things I didn't know and still don't. I'll be thinking that about myself 10 years from now too. So
all of us, we're all right there.
So the new book is called Blessed, Broken, Given, How Your Story Becomes Sacred in the Hands of Jesus. You use this, you know, the picture of Jesus breaking bread, blessing it, breaking it, and giving it. And I never, you know, as I was reading, I never realized just the ordinariness of bread. I mean, not even every culture, but like every socioeconomic status, like bread is
staple.
Yeah, it's a staple. It's a food of like peasants, and but you can also go to a fancy restaurant and get avocados on it too if you want, you know.
that's right, hipsters and peasants alike. Yeah,
but I had never thought of the significance of that being, you know, that was in the Last Supper, and that's how we celebrate communion. And we, you know, Christians to various degrees believe that there's, you know, the real presence of Christ at that table. It's almost, you might have thought that he would, choose a fancier food, you know, he's like breaking sushi or something.
Right.
You know,
that's exactly it, Shane, is there is this commonness and almost ubiquity to bread where you find it everywhere. I was saying this at a church in Queens earlier this summer, and a congregant told me that there's a bakery in Lower Manhattan that has, you know, a big poster on the wall that shows breads from all around the world. And I thought, it really is true. Breads from all around the world. And in the ancient world, it would have been the most basic, you know, staple diet as well. And I think there's something to that, because even in the Old Testament, bread gets used as this symbol of God's provision, you know, the manna from heaven or bread from heaven. Yeah. And then it becomes this metaphor for the law of the Lord. The giving of the commandments is like bread that we take in. And by the time you get to Jesus, you kind of expect now that, okay, bread is more than just bread. But Jesus takes it to a whole nother level by saying, no, I am the bread of heaven. And if you eat of my flesh, you know, you're kind of taking me in like your sustenance. But I think part of the key here is in understanding a new way of seeing the world. So chapter one of the book is really about introducing us to a sacramental way of seeing. And no matter what our view of the Lord's Supper or communion or whatever we call it, Eucharist, you know, you might have people on the high end that are like, no, no, this is, you know, real presence. And other people would say, well, it's kind of a memorial. Right. But whatever we say about that, it's hard to ignore that what Jesus is doing in that moment is taking something common and asking us to call to mind something holy. And that's a clue into seeing the whole world differently. What if we could see the whole world not simply as a common and ordinary, but actually as a carrier of the glory of God?
Yeah, I think that's such a beautiful picture and so such a welcome corrective to the kind of Christian mountaintop culture that we've really cultivated.
Well, yeah, it's true. And you have on the one hand, you know, you kind of have the, you know, what you might call the deists or the cultural Christians who are sort of like, yeah, Jesus is the Lord of the afterlife and he forgives my sins, but I'll just kind of run my life as I want to. And then on the other hand, you have a little bit of the charismatic or Pentecostal escapists that are saying, we just got to get up into the heavens and we got to experience something otherworldly, or even our language like supernatural. When we talk about God at work in the world, we're like, oh, it's beyond the natural world. And actually, the way that the Bible talks about this stuff is not a division between a natural world and then a supernatural world. The Bible talks about a world that is alive with the presence of God. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Or the angels in Isaiah 6 saying, the whole earth is full of his glory. Or Jacob waking up and saying, surely the Lord is in this place and I didn't even know it. So we've got to press beyond our kind of Western division of our space versus God's space and kind of say that maybe in the world of the Bible, all of creation is filled with the glory and presence of God.
Oh, that's so good. That reminds me of some things that I've heard N.T. Wright say about, you know, feeling like this harsh division between heaven and earth, between the supernatural and the natural that we exhibit. And, you know, it's kind of like how we read in the scriptures, you know, God's going to take care of you. He's going to feed you like he feeds the birds. And, and what we don't see when we read that, we don't picture, you know, some God's supernatural hand reaching down and feeding birds. We know that there's like a natural, way that happens. And so it seems like the Bible is advocating for this way in which God is very much present, but like you're saying, it's not always in that that kind of neo-Pentecostal, what we would identify as a miraculous way.
That's right. That's right. And you know, honestly, I mean, even some of the discussions we've had recently from people saying, you know, I can't reconcile science and belief in God. It's maybe because we have a version of belief in God that forces us to choose between a natural world and a supernatural world. And we're like, well, that just doesn't happen. God doesn't override the laws of nature, blah, blah, blah. But a sacramental worldview says, no, 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 God is, he's separate from the world. We don't believe, we're not pantheistic here, but we're not deists either, where God is just confined to an upstairs. God is very much alive and well and at work within the world by his spirit. So when we see the sunrise or the provision for birds or all of this stuff, what if we could imagine God actually active within it? God calling forth in an active way. I love that, you know, the Nicene Creed, when it talks about the Holy Spirit, it says this: we believe in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life. And there's a sense there that that's kind of a present, ongoing, he's the ongoing giver of life, not just the one who gave life at one time, you know. And I think we're happy to give God credit for getting this all started, but we miss how God is actively sustaining and giving life in every moment around the cosmos.
So, Glenn, here's why, like, I feel this is so incredibly important, because just a little bit about me, I think that in the very good times, I think this is most people, in the very good times, and kind of the glorious times in life where wonderful things are happening, and maybe you're a big life events, you're having kids, or you're getting married, or you're in the middle of a new friendship, that it is easy to feel and sense and be attentive to the presence of God in those times. And then for myself, I've noticed I'm also very much feel the presence of God in the worst times. When I have lost someone I love, there's something very palpable about the presence of God. You know, the scripture says that God is near to the brokenhearted, and I feel like I've really experienced that. But those very good times and those very bad times, they're only like 10% of my life. Right. And the 90% that's left is just kind of mundane, you know? Right. It's kind of just taking my kids to school and paying bills and working. And that's a lot of time to not be attentive to the presence of God in my life.
It's so true. And, even our brains, the way they're wired, there was a study done, some years ago about our memory. And we remember actually the least typical but the most remarkable things about our lives. So we remember the highs and the lows. And we sort of think that all of life is like that. But the reality is all of life is pretty ordinary and therefore not especially memorable, you know. So it's also then easy to think, well, if it's not that memorable, then, where's God in the midst of that? But here I think it's helpful to take the pressure off of our individual stories. I mean, one of the things I try to do in the book is, exploring each of these three words, blessed, broken, given. And in that first word, blessed, we tend to think of the blessed life as the extraordinary life, the life that is super wealthy, super successful, super influential, blah, 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 big church, for pastors out there. And that's dumb. It's not how the Bible talks about blessing. And in fact, blessedness has to do with a story that we're part of, a story that's already in progress, if you will. So, God uses this word, the Bible uses this word blessing to describe what God says about the world that he created. So you go all the way back to Genesis 1, God looks out at everything and he blessed it and he called it good. And so to, in a very real way, to be blessed is to be given a good beginning. And to be part of a story that's bigger than ourselves. And where I'm going with this is, if you recognize that you're part of a story that has a good beginning and a glorious ending and is bigger than you, you don't need every single moment of your micro story to be epic. But I think that's kind of the American lie. It's like, I got to live this epic life in every moment of every day. And if your job isn't just the best thing that you wake up and can't, then you should go searching for something else that's your dream. And it's too much pressure to make every moment grand and epic, instead of saying, I am part of the greatest story of all. I'm part of the beginning of this world and God's purposes for the world, and that's what makes me blessed. I've been brought into the Jesus story, and that matters more than my own individual moments.
Yeah. So I feel like there's two things going on there. There's this one narrative that's like the Instagram life, where I'm literally on a mountaintop and my VW bus is in the background and everything's awesome all the time, right? And then, but there's also this kind of Christian parallel to that, which is I have to do big things for God. So I've got to go to a third world country or start a nonprofit or adopt 20 kids or, X, Y, and Z and on and on. And we really cultivate that. We talk in our churches about, God fulfilling our dreams are our dreams big enough for God? And it seems like we are just kind of Christianizing the Instagram life.
Yeah, we're Christianizing even the American dream, that bigger is better grander is more glorious. And that is what I love about Jesus taking bread. You alluded to this. He could have picked a more exotic sort of meal item, but he chose bread as a way of saying, no, I am this. I am God incarnate. I'm God in flesh. And there's nothing more earthy or human than bread, which comes from wheat, which comes from dirt. There's something very grounding about that and comforting to say to us, And no moment is too ordinary for God. He loves it. He delights in it. He specializes in filling it with his glory. And of course, you know, Shane, I always think about the classic Brother Lawrence book, Practicing the Presence of God.
Yes.
The habit of being able to turn our heart and our mind to the Lord, even while peeling potatoes and doing the dishes. And so a lot of this is just seeing with new eyes, seeing with a different kind of perspective.
You know, part of the irony of like Brother Lawrence, for instance, is he did this thing. He was just working in a kitchen. Yeah. But now today, we all know about him and we've all, you know, read his book. And I think we forget that like the world in Christian history is filled with Brother Lawrences that we never knew about.
That's a great point. Absolutely right.
I was preaching recently and I was reading or mentioning this book that I've been reading about kind of Christian peacemaking. And I was reading these stories of people who had done these great acts of forgiveness. Some stories were more famous than others, but more like, you know, recent history, this woman whose daughter was kidnapped by the Lord's Resistant Army in 1996 and had never saw her daughter again, but started this organization to bring reconciliation, and part of their mission was full forgiveness of the people who had done this thing. And wow. Another story was like John Perkins, who was beaten and tortured by White Highway Patrol in the 70s and in 1970, and then goes on to start this beautiful multi-ethnic church. So stories like that over and over again. And I was reading them and then kind of realizing, you know, looking at people's faces, kind of like, that's great, but, you know, my life is so incredibly ordinary compared to those. And I just thought about the ways in which we can be faithful and that God can turn our mundane existence into something. And also that we might need not even know about the impacts that that causes. I was thinking about, so I preached this sermon the morning after the latest two mass shootings had happened, the one in El Paso and the one in Dayton. And I was thinking, just because I knew more about the incidents, I was thinking about the one in El Paso. This guy drives from Dallas, Texas to El Paso and, you know, commits this awful atrocity, and it's based on, his racism and his hate.
Right.
And I thought, this guy lived in Dallas, Texas. Dallas, Texas is lousy with Christians. I mean, they're everywhere. And I just wondered if that guy had any neighbors that had ever invited him over for dinner, had ever listened to his story, had ever, you know, lovingly challenged any ideology in his mind. And I thought, if that had happened, those people would never have known what they were stepping in front of.
We have no idea how our little actions and kindness and all that stuff actually plays a part in the grand story.
So I wonder if you have words for people, people like me, like we want to be attentive to God. We want to be faithful. But life is so, one is monotonous and mundane, but it's also just so busy. Like and it seems like we're just trying to get through the day. You know, I'm rushing to get ready to get my kids to school, and then I'm rushing to work. And then, you know, I've got to pay bills and, you know, got to run to Home Depot or like whatever it is. How do we see the blessed, you know, bread, the gift that God's given us in those moments?
Well, it's a really great question, Shane. And I think each of the three words, blessed, broken, given, kind of allude or speak to some of our, maybe our objections or our excuses or our, you know, the things that we feel disqualify us, you know. So that word blessed, I use in the book to talk about our sense of ordinariness and less thanness, and recalibrating that word to mean to be blessed is to have God retell your story, rename you, redirect your destiny. I mean, you know, you were talking about what if someone had met that guy and invited him over. In the book, I talk about the angel of the Lord interrupting Hagar in the wilderness, Hagar on the run, and saying to her, where have you come from and where are you going? And just how those stories can redirect us and remind us of our blessing in Christ. But then that word broken kind of addresses, you know, the sense of inadequacy, maybe even of disqualification. Broken can refer to our frailty. I just can't, you know, I can't, I'm overwhelmed. It can refer to our, you know, like to say, well, I've messed up. Do I still get to participate? It can also refer to the pain, you know, the fallenness of the world, and to say, well, I just can't manage anything more right now. And then the you know, the word given is about understanding that there's purpose even in the midst of where we are. So one of the things I would encourage listeners to think about is it may not be about adding something new to your schedule. It may not be about taking on a new a commitment or a new yes to the Lord. It may simply be about saying, God, send me into what's already on my calendar today. So send me into this appointment. Send me into this carpool duty. Send me into that. And help me to see myself as a missionary in those moments. Help me to see myself as being given for the life of the world in those moments. I mean, I think about Jesus in the Gospels. So many of his moments of profound interaction with people were unscripted. They were on the way somewhere else, you know.
Yeah.
Even one of the great blessed, broken, given stories in Luke's Gospel is Jesus is having a retreat time with his disciples and the crowds interrupt. And Jesus says, okay, well, let's not send them away. Let's welcome them. Let's teach them. Let's feed them. And it becomes this amazing moment. And I think there's some clue in there for us about saying, no, man, the blessing and the brokenness and the givenness, this whole sacred work of God is happening right in the midst of our schedule if we turn it over to the Lord, surrender it to him, and ask him to give us new perspective.
There are so many people who are so beat up by life. Maybe it's relationships that have gone awry, or maybe it's just messages that society sends them that they're not good enough. Mm. And then we come and Jesus also has this message of brokenness.
Yeah.
And if we're not careful, that sounds like just an echo of what everyone else has already been telling us. And how is Jesus's message different than those other messages?
That's great. That's really great. And I think it is important to distinguish that. I think something happens when we place our brokenness in Jesus's hands, or even if we want to say it this way, that he's breaking us. Brokenness in Jesus's hands is always about openness. It's always about opening us up. And I think it's a twofold opening up. I think it's an opening us up to others. You know, here again, that Luke 9 story, the disciples are like, send them away. And Jesus is like, no, you give them something to eat. Open your hearts up to these people. And they're like, well, we don't have anything. And, you know, organize them in groups. And then, you know, and he does this miracle of multiplication. But then what's a nice little detail in the story is Jesus gives the bread back to the disciples to give to the people. And I thought, man, if Jesus could do the miracle of multiplication, couldn't he do the miracle of distribution, you know, just have it all plated and land on their laps, you know? Why get the disciples involved? Because he's trying to open our hearts up to others. He's trying to get us to see beyond ourselves. And so just as bread that is not broken cannot be shared, so our lives can't really enter into that koinonia, that true fellowship, that sharing of heart and soul with each other until we allow our brokenness to open us up. So, you know, I think of times in my life, man, when we've gone through stuff. I mean, I share in the book about my wife's kind of postpartum struggle after our fourth child. I talk about different moments of discouragement in pastoral ministry. And in each of those moments, there was a chance there. There was an opportunity there to be opened up to someone else. But then the other, you know, the other movement, it opens us up to God, to his grace. Because unlike, you know, sometimes we hear people talk about vulnerability and brokenness, and it's almost like a badge of honor, or it's almost like an end in itself. Like, yeah, man, this is how broken I am. But in the kingdom, brokenness is supposed to kind of result in a new kind of wholeness. And so I think about that Japanese art of pottery kintsugi, you know, where the bowl is broken, but it's repaired with these seams that look like gold, and it ends up being more valuable, more precious, more desirable. And that's a picture of what Jesus does, what grace does, is when our brokenness opens us up to God, his grace comes rushing in, and the result is always something more beautiful than it was before. So he doesn't leave us in this place of saying, yeah, I'm in pain, or yeah, I'm struggling, or yeah, I've messed up. And he doesn't just say, well, cool, me too, let's all commiserate. You know, there's something, you know, there's something beyond.
That I love that metaphor, and you've posted online a few times these pictures of these bowls. What did you say they're called?
They're called kintsugi, and it literally means golden joinery. And it was in the like 1500s, 1400s, 1500s, and it got to the point where pottery dealers would intentionally break bowls so that they could repair them, because it became more valuable, more desirable to have these ones with the golden seams in them. And that's just such a beautiful picture of redemption, how God can take brokenness and make us more beautiful than we were before.
I think that tells us so much, because one, those bowls are beautiful. I mean, they're like just breathtakingly beautiful. But I think it also tells us something, because I think that we often think that healing and redemption is going to look like taking those cracks away completely, like it was before.
Yeah.
And it's not. You can see the cracks even better in those bowls, because they're lined in this beautiful gold. Right. And so I think that that's such a beautiful picture, because many times we have to redefine what healing looks like in the faith.
Yeah.
And I heard someone say one time that they didn't trust, they were talking about pastors or leaders, but I think it applies to everyone. They didn't trust a pastor without a limp.
Yeah.
And I love that, because it is difficult for me to be vulnerable with someone that I perceive doesn't have any problems.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a call and invitation for Christians to fill in our cracks with that gold inlay, that they shine all the brighter. Because people need that.
Absolutely right, man. And that, you know, that's Paul in 2 Corinthians saying, you know, and it's also like Jesus after the resurrection showing his scars to Thomas. Like, isn't that amazing? I mean, N.T. Wright talks about this, that there is this sense of discontinuity and continuity between, you know, pre-resurrection Jesus body and resurrection Jesus body. And the point there is his body does not erase the scars and the wounds. It is glorified, and yet the scars are there. And so there's something to this about redemption and resurrection. Yes, it takes what we've gone through, and it does bring something glorious that we could never have imagined. And yet it shows the scars. They're right there. Hmm.
Well, towards the end of the book, you kind of dig into the story of Herod beheading John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. And he, right after they do that, they have a feast. Herod has a feast. And almost simultaneously to this, Jesus is feeding the 5,000.
Yeah.
And you kind of contrast those two. There are two feasts going on, mm-hmm. but they're radically different. And part of, I think people don't often grasp this. It's kind of lost in history, but it was so very important for Rome to remain in power to balance out other powers. Rome was kind of somewhat happy to allow the Jews to be Jews, because if they didn't, if they tried to crack down on that, there could be some kind of rebellion or something. And they were, as long as that didn't threaten the empire, they were kind of okay with that. But then this is part of why Jesus winds up on the cross. You can't just go around Rome preaching an alternative kingdom. Mm-hmm. And so John the Baptist was also seen as this leader. Herod had to somewhat be cajoled into beheading John the Baptist, but was really happy to, because that was one less problem to deal with in the empire. And so that is, it's such a good picture of empire. They see everything as a zero sum game. And by the way, some of our current political leaders see that if someone else is doing good, then that means that we're not doing as well. We can't see, there's no way for us to all succeed. That's how empires see power.
Right.
And yet, here is Jesus making more than enough out of just a few things. Jesus is making more. So it's this contrasting economies of power. Yeah. Where Jesus is an economy of abundance, whereas Herod's and the empire is an economy of scarcity.
Scarcity, exactly right. That's exactly right. Herod functions on the premise that if someone else has power, then that's less for me.
Yep.
And Jesus' kingdom functions on where there's not enough, I'm going to provide more than enough, because when everybody's fed, it's better for everyone. You know, so the contrasts are incredible, and Mark's gospel places them side by side almost to call it out on purpose, I think. You know, you have in Herod's party, it's all the who's. In Jesus's party, it's uninvited guests. It's basically this whole crowd that nobody invited, but they showed up. And I love it because it says, and Jesus welcomed them. So even if they weren't invited, they were welcomed. And that's such a beautiful picture of the heart of Jesus, the one who will never turn us away. And then you kind of have in Herod's party, someone has to dance to get a favor granted. You know, you got to perform, basically. And in Jesus's feast, you don't have to perform. He has compassion. Mark tells us he's moved with compassion when he sees the crowd. And in fact, Mark says that he saw them like sheep without a shepherd, which is a key phrase in the Bible. It's a key phrase that is meant to make us think about the prophecies about Israel's king, how Israel's king was supposed to be like a good shepherd, and all of the Davidic sort of echoes and the messianic hopes. But there's this long passage in Ezekiel where God compares the kings of Israel to bad shepherds. He says, you're like the shepherds who don't take care of the sheep, and you don't bind up the broken, and you don't go and rescue the strays. And so then God basically says, you know what? I'm going to do the job myself. I'm going to come. I'm going to be the shepherd of Israel. So when we see these two stories side by side, it's almost like, it really is like a political expose. It's the gospel writer saying, you think Herod is the king of Israel? He's a sham of a king. He's like the bad shepherd that Ezekiel warned about. And who's Jesus? Jesus is God who's come to do the job himself. Jesus is God who's come to be king of Israel himself. And look what a good shepherd he is. He gathers in these tired and weary people from all around the neighboring areas. He feeds them. He heals them. He teaches them. He does everything a good shepherd and a good king is supposed to do.
That's so good, Glenn. Well, once again, the book is called Blessed, Broken, Given, How Your Story Becomes Sacred in the Hands of Jesus. Glenn, is the book out yet?
It is.
Okay, cool.
It is. It came out on August 6th, and it's, you know, available wherever books are sold. Amazon, of course, has it. Christian Book Distributors has it, you know, Barnes & Noble, wherever you want. The Audible version of the book, I read the audio version of the book, and they've got that on audio CD, but the Audible version is supposed to be out anytime now. So,
oh, that's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I know that glimpakium.com is one way to find you. Are there others?
I'm, you know, like you, fairly active on social media. So if people want to follow along on Twitter, it's at GPakium, or on Instagram at GPakium. The only tricky part there is Pakium is P-A-C-K-I-A-M. Other than that, you know, should be easy to find.
Cool. Well, I usually, when I publish episodes, I go on Twitter to say so, and I usually tag the author, so I'll be sure to tag you there if anyone who follows me wants to follow you. So, Glenn, man, it's been so good to just kind of follow you throughout the years and, you know, catch a stray sermon or podcast or, you've written a few things for missioalliance.org. And, man, it's been so good just kind of learning from you from afar these years. So thanks for all you do. And thanks for coming to Seminary Dropout again.
Thank you so much, Shane. And thank you for what you do, man. I love the podcast and love the way that you bring out such wonderful conversations. So grateful to be part.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have, and I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,